Hey, Randy.
All right, thanks, Kun. It's a real pleasure to be here. It's nice to meet you all. In my house, we have leftovers of the week, so I'm not sure I like being the experimentalist of the week. Usually by the end of the week, the leftover of the week, not so good. So this is Rice University. This happens to be the physics building here, and some people have commented on what a great looking building that is. This was built exactly 90 years ago, and now, 90 years later, we're getting a new physics building. So finally, after 90 years, we're going to have the groundbreaking was last week, and so we're going to have a building in which all the physicists, not just the theorists who can live in these pretty offices overlooking this nice scenery, can live in. So today, as Kun said, I'll be talking about fermion pairing with unbalanced spin populations. From 3D to 1D. I apologize, I've gotten a cold. And I visited my father in Northern California, and as soon as I got to California, I started getting a cold. I don't think it's correlated. But so I'll be talking about pairing with unequal spins. And the observation that we make is phase separation. And I think interestingly, you can see a geometrical dependence of density deformation in these systems. And if you go all the way to 1D, these are very elongated 3D systems, but if you go all the way to 1D, there should be a dimensional crossover. We're starting to get some preliminary data on this. We have a DARPA team, which Jason is a proud member of our DARPA team, and hopefully he'll be encouraged by this data, because our phase one is up in 2 months, so we're on the line. We have new data. All right, so there's been quite a bit of interest, of course, in ultra-cold atomic gases for a number of years now, and I think increasing interest in fermions. And maybe interest isn't the right word to say, but really increasing capabilities with ultra-cold Fermi gases. And from my perspective, I guess the most interesting thing to me is the connections that we can make in these systems to other areas of physics. So high TC superconductors, maybe we should be able to realize the Hubbard model. Neutron stars, equation of state, quark gluon plasmas, variety of things in QCD physics. Condensed matter physics, of course. It's possible to realize the Fermi-Hubbard model. People have seen the Mott insulator in both bosons and fermions now. One could study pseudogap physics, strong correlations in low dimensions, so letting your liquids, presumably spin shard separation. A lot of this is now potential. I'm putting here a list of things that not necessarily have been accomplished, but things that we can aim for and I think realistically obtain. And of course, the thing we're really aiming for is new physics. And it's not so much as to reproduce every model of condensed matter physics, but rather to learn something new. And one of the things that helps us in this regard are these optical lattices. So optical lattices are standing waves of light, and they're a way of imposing some periodicity onto the atoms. So in 1D, you can make a one-dimensional array of pancakes. A 2D lattice consists of a 2D array of one-dimensional tubes, and so on. And so this is the experiment that I'll be talking about to the end of my talk. All right, so just to kind of set the scale a little bit, this picture goes back long before cold atoms. This is really goes back to Tony Leggett, 1980, and maybe even further back than that, 1969 with Eagles. But the idea is that if you increase coupling between atoms, between pairs, the pairs get smaller and smaller until eventually they go from a nice BCS Cooper pair-like picture to a BEC of molecules picture, and then something in between, which is neither BCS nor BEC. And this is the so-called unitarity limit, where the pair size is about equal to the interparticle distance. All right, so one way you can imagine doing this is that if you had a two-body interaction potential and had an adjustable depth, U naught, with a knob on it, you could make this deeper and deeper, and as you did so, the attractive interactions would get stronger. Eventually, you'd support a bound state right here at the unitarity limit, just supports a single bound state. And as you go deeper in, this molecule becomes smaller and smaller spatially until eventually there's no more fermion degrees of freedom left, and it really is a composite boson. So this is the way this picture would look if you were to express the interaction strength or the S-wave scattering length versus the depth of the potential U-naught. It would start initially as being weakly attractive, a little bit negative, and as you approach this resonance condition, A would go to infinity, negative infinity. You go to the other side, it goes to positive infinity, and so on. It goes back to the other side. So it's this region in here, which is probably the most interesting, but it's kind of, I think, remarkable that you can make that connection between BCS physics to BEC physics. Ultimately, what this is saying is that the order parameter is the same. It's a paired order parameter, and it's a crossover. You're going continuously from one picture to another. All right, so that kind of sets the stage. The usual situation is certainly in superconductors, is that you have an equal number of spin-up and spin-down particles. It's an unpolarized gas. You try to apply a magnetic field to a superconductor, and usually it gets expelled. Usually it's difficult to magnetize a superconductor. And therefore, these two Fermi energies sit on top of each other. Now, it's still possible to ask the question, well, what happens if you are able to unbalance this in some way? And so the Fermi energies are not the same. So the spin-up Fermi energy in blue is maybe somewhat greater than the spin-down in red. And there are a number of ways that you could think about doing that, and one is if you can magnetize a superconductor. In certain heavy fermion compounds, it is possible to do that. Pairing of quarks and neutron stars, where you have different mass quarks from the different families, and they will again have different Fermi energies. But then with cold atoms, it turned out to be relatively straightforward. The spin states that we're talking about are just the hyperfine sublevels of the atom. And so if you can make an imbalanced mixture of these hyperfine sublevels, you can realize the situation. All right, so going back now probably about 40 years, over 40 years, almost from the outset of BCS theory, people have wondered about what would happen if you were to make such a magnetized superconductor. And one of the earliest things is the FFLO state. This stands for the authors who proposed the idea. And the idea here is that the pairs have a non-zero momentum. So there's a modulated order parameter. Instead of having zero momentum pairs as in BCS, you have pairs that are either momentum on this side of the Fermi surface or on the other side. And so there's some Q, which is the Fermi wave vector difference between these two species. Another idea is called a deformed Fermi surface. And the idea is here, where there's, again, a breaking of symmetry for these Fermi surfaces to at least contact somewhere and be able to have the ability to pair. Another idea is just a polarized superfluid. If the chemical potential difference is sufficiently small, then it's just ordinary BCS. But if it is bigger than the superconducting gap, then you have something more exotic, which has been called a breach pair, which is some kind of a gapless, has gapless excitations. And then finally, it's possible that you can have phase separation. Where all these others are in K space, this is in real space. And so you could see that what happens is the smaller Fermi surface sits inside, or the smaller now, not Fermi surface, but smaller volume, sits inside the bigger one, and you have a nice BCS superfluid inside, and you have polarized or the remaining unpaired atoms sitting outside.
Why is it inside and outside? Could it be some other configuration? Or?
Yeah, sure. And so what I'm anticipating here is a trap situation where the chemical potential is largest in the center, and that favors having the pair sit in the middle. But you're right. I mean, in general, that doesn't have to be the case. Okay. So, in a trap, you can have then this gap has become a parameter of the radius in the trap, is some harmonic potential. And if you have phase separation, then you have this clear distinction between pairs in the center and unpaired atoms on the outside. This is what the phase separation might look like in the trap. Whereas if you have this polarized superfluid, you have a no sharp boundary, but some kind of a mixture of polarization, some kind of excitations that exist in a continuous way as you go through the trap. So these are really quite distinct.
Can you say a bit more about the Hausdorff dummy surface?
Yeah, so this is an idea of some people in Germany named, help me out here, Sedrakian and Murphy? I can't remember. Have to ask me later.
These are nuclear zeros.
Yeah.
But is that a paired state or is it Fermi liquid? What is it?
It's a state which is like the FFLO state in that it breaks the spatial symmetry, but the symmetry is this deformation of this Fermi surface. So it's not isotropic anymore, as it would be up in here. Instead of here, there's a shift in momentum space. Rather than this situation, there's some kind of a deformation in different directions, different spatial directions.
You pay a lot of energy in pairing, but then you pay a lot of energy in deforming from the surface.
And the difference between the last two pictures are basically the excitations that you have in the interface.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so you can have, in this polarized superfluid, you can have excitations, and so it's possible that you have a polarization that varies continuously as you go from the middle of the trap to the outer edges. Whereas in the phase separation idea, you have a first order phase boundary, and I'll show this a little bit later. You have a first order phase boundary, and and this boundary is then very sharp. All right. So in cold atoms, the states, the two different spin states, are not states really of different spin. Magnetic fields really affect them in different ways. They're states that are just different hyperfine sublevels. Okay, so they really think of these as not being an electron spin up and spin down. In fact, they're both electron spin down, but they have different nuclear spin projections, which means that they are distinguishable. They are about 4 millikelvin in energy apart at a certain magnetic field. And by driving RF transitions from one state to another, you can control the population of one of these states relative to the other one. And they stay that way. There's no spin relaxation. And so the magnetic field, if you like, is something which is imposed upon the system by the spin imbalance. And it doesn't go away. It gets frozen in there. Okay, so the polarization is defined to be this number difference divided by the total number for the two different states. And for us, you can see this goes from -1 to 1, but for us, state 1 is always the majority, so we're looking at just this half axis where P is positive. P equals 0 is the case, the usual BCS, this one. And P different from zero is this case. And so then we do usual things that we do in this business, which is to take images. And you take absorption or phase contrast images, and that enables you to extract things like temperature and number. And once you have number, then you can evaluate what this polarization is. And these experiments were done both at MIT and at Rice a few years ago. All right, so I'll show a series of images here. Here again is this definition of P. All of these are at the so-called unitarity limit. This is where A goes to infinity. So right in the regime of not BCS, not BEC, but right in between. And all of these, the lowest temperature that we can obtain and measure is about 20% of the Fermi temperature, about 5% of the Fermi temperature. All right, so this is a situation, this is a usual situation where you have equal numbers of state 1 and state 2, and this is the difference. So these are the two images that we take, and then this is, we get this one by processing it. Now, this is a sequence showing you the, how the system evolves with increasing polarization, going from 18% up to about 95. And everything I want to say about the 3D case really can be said here on this slide. You can really, if you bear with me for a few minutes, we can analyze these images and we can, and at least in a qualitative way, we can understand what's happening, what it is that we're seeing. All right, so there's a number of things I want to point out. One is in these different images, you notice each of these, there's a dark center, which has essentially the same color as the background. What that signifies is that there's an equal population of state 1 and state 2. And that's why they subtract to be essentially zero. So there is apparently a paired core. Now, if that is the paired core, then you can look at this dark image. You can see, well, this distribution of state 2 represents the distribution of that paired core, whereas the excess fermions are represented by the difference.
What is this contour? What exactly are we looking at?
Okay, so so what we're looking at is the column density of the gas. So we have we've loaded a trap, we've done evaporative cooling, we prepared this polarization. Then we flash on some light, which is near resonance, and that light is absorbed by the atoms, and it casts a shadow onto a camera that can be imaged. And that's what these are. So these are two-dimensional column density images. They're a projection along the laser beam axis. Okay. So these are the excess fermions here in the difference distribution. That's number one. The second point is that these phase boundaries between this core, this paired core, and the excess fermions are very sharp. If you look at these, they're, I mean, all of them, if you look closely enough, you can see that they have very relatively hard edges. Thirdly, this core is deformed. Now, this is odd. You know, remember that these are atoms in a harmonic potential. And as you decrease the number of atoms in the harmonic potential, then what should happen is that the whole cloud gets smaller in every dimension because it has to sit in the equipotentials of this trap. And that's clearly not happening. And so this cloud is clearly shrinking more axially and expanding radially than you would expect from looking at these distributions of the basically the equipotential lines of the trap. And I'll make all of these points more quantitative in the following slides. And so this deformation continues to grow. You can see it becomes extreme when you get to very high polarizations. And so what we conclude from this is that there's a phase separation, that this is a superfluid core, that which is equally paired, that these are the excess unpaired atoms that are fully polarized, and they sit somehow on the outside. They don't really fill in the shell uniformly around the core, but rather they sit on the outside. And you can see that a little bit better from this three-dimensional picture. This clear part in the middle is the distribution of state 2. That's that superfluid core. This stuff around the edges, this more opaque stuff, is the difference. And you can see that the atoms, the excess fermions, are collecting predominantly at the ends of this elongated cigar-shaped trap, and very few of them around this equatorial plane. So there's, and this is a manifestation of that deformation.
Distinguish between SARMA and true phase separation, because true phase separation is a first order phase transition, something conceptually very stringent. And what else there, by looking at the figure, okay, I would say it is separated, but are you never there to say it's a first order phase, it's a first order phase transition with a true phase separation?
Yeah, so I'll show that, and I'll show that in a little bit. So the SARMA phase, actually the boundary is the second order.
Yes.
And this is sharp. This is really a first order. And the key to... It's always sharp. And the key to all this is this deformation.
If you look at the density, there's a jump in it.
Yes.
What determines the direction of the deformation? Is there some symmetry in the confining potential, or...?
So there's... in the trapping potential itself?
Or, well, what determines the direction of the deformation?
Let me back up a little bit. So, the aspect ratio of the trap is 30 to 1. And so the radial frequency is 30 times greater than the axial frequency. We've redisplayed this a little bit to be able to see the radial direction. But this is actually 30 to 1. And the deformation occurs along this long axis.
So it's just the trap shape?
It's the trap shape. So the symmetry is broken by the trap. And I'll show you some stuff at the end. We've done the same experiment, but without the elongated trap.
Why would you expect,
but a more spherical one.
Why would you expect then things to keep the same shape if the symmetry is broken anyway? I mean,
so it violates the local density approximation. So somehow the energy has to come from somewhere. So you've got these, you know, you've got a chemical potential which is varying harmonically. And somehow the trap assumes a shape which is not reflective at all of that underlying potential. And so that's weird. There's no other way of saying it. That's just weird. And I'll show you why it happens here in a second. We understand it. Okay. So just to make this point more quantitative, this is the aspect ratio of those clouds, the function of polarization. This is state 2. This is state 1, and you can see that the aspect ratio for state 1, the majority, is really pretty independent of polarization. Whereas this state 2, representing the core, is the aspect ratio is getting shorter and shorter, getting squeezed, axially expanded radially, until the aspect ratio at the highest polarization is about 1. So it's changed by over an order of magnitude. That's a very significant effect. Now, because of this effect, this is what we call the axial densities. You take these column densities, you integrate one more time along this remaining radial dimension, and you get something which has dimensions of 1 over length versus z, which is the long axis. And what we see here, because of this deformation, and the difference is a dip like that. That dip is a manifestation of that deformation. And so it's real easy. It's real striking. All right, so what's going on? So what's going on was actually figured out by Teja da Silva and Eric Mueller. The surface tension, it's a first-order phase boundary. And at a first-order phase transition, there's going to be some surface energy, and you have to account for that. And so without surface tension, this is this dotted line here is the theory without surface tension. Doesn't fit at all, doesn't have that dip. With surface tension, it does. And it theory matches pretty well for a wide range of this polarization. Hank Stoff did the same thing. This is a collaboration between Hank's group and my group. Hank's calculations are in blue. They're hard to see, except if you go over in here and you look in the difference distribution, you can see how well they fit. And so all he is fitting here is a single parameter, which is the scale parameter between the Fermi energy and the surface energy. And that same scale parameter works for all P. And so that gives us some confidence, the fact that that's the case, it gives us some confidence that this is a reasonable explanation for this deformation.
So this group also, they also take the surface tension as a parameter and fit. The surface tension.
Yeah, so this is a fit where this basically a fit to this parameter. Okay.
There's one parameter because it's always phase separated between 100% polarized state and
Yeah, that's exactly what we see. Is the phase boundary goes almost from being P equals 0 to P equals 1 in a very short distance. Okay, so we can look, everything I've shown you so far are either column densities or integrated axial densities. And it turns out that you can do a form of tomography taking advantage of the cylindrical symmetry of the trap. You can do something called an Abel transform, and you can extract from these column densities, you can extract real densities. So these are real three-dimensional densities. It happens to get very noisy when you do that because signal-to-noise wasn't very good to start with, and you've made it worse. But again, you see that the phase boundary is very steep. And the other point that I want to make is that the central density is zero within our ability to measure it. All right, so if you look now, since we can evaluate what the central density is for both species, you can take the ratio of those. If it's uniformly paired, then that ratio should be 1. And indeed, it's 1 for all the way up to about 95% polarization, and then it starts to deviate. And there's not very many atoms over here. The signal-to-noise is not getting very good. But it is quite distinct from the expectations for normal gas. So if this were a non-interacting gas, a Bang local density approximation, you would see that for the central ratio, and that's not what we're seeing. We see something which is very close to 1. And interestingly, very close to 1 for very high polarizations. So the fact that that polarization goes up so big turns out, with a little bit of theory, that, actually a lot of theory, some Monte Carlo calculations, that this condition is within factors of 2. This condition is here at about 75% polarization. And so we're actually going beyond that. And that's unexpected. And so that has to be a consequence of the fact that there's a violation of local density approximation and these calculations aren't valid anymore, which are valid for a homogeneous system. And apparently this doesn't behave like a homogeneous system. All right, so this is...
There's one point.
Yeah, I know everybody asks about that point. The purpose of that point is to show you that I'm honest. but this point literally represents a few thousand atoms in the minority state, and we just don't have that good of number measurement. And so I can't... The error bar on this thing, on that point, is huge. All right, so I told you that MIT did a very similar experiment to ours. It's similar, but they get some different results. They get this axial density being flat-topped, which I told you would be the case if local density approximation was not violated, where we see this kind of meniscus-like deformation that I told you was due to the surface tension. They also see a partially polarized shell. You can see how this drops off. And no deformation. Otherwise, you would see some kind of a little dip in here. And for them, they see a critical polarization at what people have calculated now is this so-called Clogston-Chandrasekhar limit, which is about 75%, where superfluidity breaks down. And they, in fact, do see breakdown of superfluidity at that expected value. We don't. We see some different things. We see a rather sharp phase boundary, this deformation, and the critical polarization, which is really big, a lot bigger than 75%. So what's going on? So at MIT, they have a relatively, it's not spherical, but it's much less elongated than ours, an aspect ratio of 6 instead of 30. They also have 10 to the 7 atoms instead of 300,000. And so it's a system which you might expect to behave more like a homogeneous system. And their temperature is pretty similar to ours. So what are these differences due to, and are they indeed due to this geometrical dependence? So we set out to explore, yeah?
The PF is the center of the trap.
What?
The PF is at the center of the trap.
The C?
The PF, the Fermi temperature.
Oh. Yeah, sorry. So the Fermi temperature is just defined in terms of number. So it's related. So the Fermi temperature is we We define it in terms of the majority.
At the center of the trap?
No, so this is, that's for a trap. So that already takes into account the inhomogeneity. That is the Fermi energy of a non-interacting species. So if I were to add one more particle, that's how much energy it would take. Okay, so we set out to explore this geometrical dependence, and we went back to our original trap with high aspect ratio, and we also added in a cross beam that softens the trap up a little bit by tightening the potential in the axial direction, so it actually makes it more spherical, aspect ratio of 6, or you can go all the way to a full cross beam trap with elliptical beams, and we get an aspect ratio of 3. So it's possible for us to tune anywhere from about 3 up to 25 rather continuously. And this is what we've seen. So for an aspect ratio of 12, we still see the deformation. This is, again, that hallmark, the fact that you see a dip instead of a flat top for the difference. The aspect ratio is still polarization dependent, and there's no Clogiston limit. But if you go to an aspect ratio of 3, then you can see immediately, just by looking at these images, that characteristic of that image is far different than this one. So instead of having the atoms collect at these axial poles, you have this nice symmetric shell going around it. Indeed, you get the flat top, and you get that the aspect ratio doesn't change as a function of polarization, or it does weakly. Has to do with temperature, we believe. All right, so again, you can plot this ratio of the central densities versus polarization. This is aspect ratio of 12. Right around 90% or so, it seems to go normal. Whereas an aspect ratio of 3, look at that, right around 75%, it seems to go normal. So it really seems like there is a geometrical dependence to this. And it was clear that the MIT experiment was on this side of those conditions, and we were on the other side of those conditions.
But the effective temperature in both of these experiments are the same?
Yes. Yeah, so this the temperature here was something less than 0.1. The temperature here was something less than 0.1, but we don't have a good handle on exactly what the temperature is. One of the issues in this business is that thermometry, when you get below about 0.1 TF, becomes really hard. And but we do know that we're well below the temperature where it phase separates based on our previous work. All right, so this is a proposed phase diagram. This is from Dan Sheehy and Leo Radziowski, and showing as a function of scattering length or interaction, going from the BEC limit to the BCS limit, showing three phases. A normal phase in the BCS limit as a function of number mismatch. A normal phase, a phase-separated phase, and then this kind of magnetized superfluid. So this is what we were talking about before, where you have you can have a continuous transition from a BCS-like state to having unpaired atoms coexist with those, in this case, BEC side with the molecules. So the idea here is easy to understand, I think, that when you're far in the BEC limit, molecules are very robust. They're not easily disrupted. You put a few unpaired atoms in with the molecules, and it doesn't perturb them significantly, and they remain paired. On the other hand, we know in BCS side that these pairs are very fragile, and if you add too much mismatch in the chemical potentials, then it goes normal. This little red line right here is what they claim is FFLO. So when we saw this, it was a little discouraging, because that was certainly one of the motivations for this work, was to explore the possibility of seeing some of these exotic phases. And we haven't seen it. We haven't seen FFLO state. And if Leo and Dan are right, then we're not going to. because that's this much too small. And so we've kind of given up in 3D on the FFLO state. But if you go to 1D, situation is different. So this is a, these are papers by Orso and Trento and Hu, Liu, and Drummond in Australia. And this is a phase diagram of chemical potential versus magnetic field in 1D. And there are three phases. There's a partially polarized phase, which they find is an FFLO state, a fully paired phase, and a fully polarized phase. So again, phase separation between phases as you change chemical potential. So this FFLO state turns out you can't avoid in 1D. I mean, it's always there. And so if you want to look for FFLO physics, this might be a place to look. The other interesting aspect of this is that this is the center of the trap over in here. And so as you go from the center of the trap, it's partially polarized in the middle, the high density region, and it becomes, as you scan density, you scan chemical potential, it becomes either fully polarized on the edges or it becomes fully paired on the edges. So this is completely inverted from the 3D case. This is rather remarkable. So the fully paired phases sit on the outside rather than on the inside in 1D, because you're scanning from high density to low density as you go through the edges with H constant. So in this system, there are tunable parameters, things that you can play with, interaction strength, polarization, and number.
What is EB, the energy unit?
That's what?
EB,
H over
EB, for
example,
for the...
EB?
Yeah.
This is binding energy of this molecule.
So what is A perpendicular?
A perpendicular is the lattice dimension, so it depends on how tight the lattice is. So it's of order, I'll get to this in a minute. So that's of order of half a micron or so, a little less.
So when A is infinity, that is unitary, what happens to that? That A, is that entire
thing
in the denominator?
Yeah. So what you get is what's been called a confinement-induced resonance. So in 3D, function of magnetic field, you have a resonance. You have a resonance there. It turns out in 1D, you have a resonance that comes early. And this occurs when A perp is about equal to A. Might be a minus sign in there. So this is 1D. So this is the work of Maxime Olshany, who worked out this one-dimensional physics. Okay, so what we decided to do was to create a one-dimensional system using an optical lattice. And the idea is the following. So you have a laser beam, a standing wave, and two directions, and the intersection of that standing wave is, you can see it here probably better, you have these pancakes that are formed by the 1D lattice. You impose two of them together, and the result is an array, a two-dimensional array of 1D tubes. And each tube is basically half the wavelength of the lattice beam, so this is about half a micron. In our case, they're about half a millimeter long. There's about 100 atoms in the center tube, and as you go out radially, the number of atoms goes to zero continuously.
What's the tube spacing?
What's that?
the spacing, the distance between them.
Yeah, so the spacing between two is about a half a micron.
As well.
Yeah, which is the periodicity of the lattice. So this is, sorry if you can't see this very well.
So they actually overlap significantly.
Pardon?
The neighboring tubes actually overlap or not?
The neighboring tubes?
Yes.
Good question. So you can adjust that because you have a knob on the hopping between tubes. You can control T. And that's controlled entirely by controlling this depth of the lattice.
Wow.
And so at that kind of depth, 15 recoils, we know these tubes are independent. But if you get down to about 6 recoils, we know that they're not. And they start to talk to each other. And that's a very interesting aspect of this system, as I'll explain. So Eric Mueller figured out that there is a critical polarization where you have above it the FFLO center in both cases, but polarized wings for high total polarization or paired wings for low total polarization. So let me back up to that phase diagram. And you're either here with low polarization, where you have fully paired wings, or at high polarization, you're at fully polarized wings. And what Eric found was that for our parameters, that polarization occurs somewhere around 18%. So that's very convenient. And so for low polarizations below this 18%, you should get paired wings above 18% polarized wings. So this is how we are detecting the phases and doing the data analysis. This is an idea, again, of Eric's. Again, there's about 100 atoms per tube. We're in the strong attraction limit. We're sitting basically on this diagram. We're kind of sitting, I guess we're sitting here, which is still, I didn't draw this very well. This is where this 1D interaction is still big. And what Eric found was that in harmonic trap, that the central, you can extract the density of the central tube via the axial density that I already defined. It's the twice integrated column density. And because of that, it turns out that this derivative gives you the central density directly, proportional to that. And so by measuring these integrated column densities, these axial densities, you're able to extract the phases. And Eric's worked out the expected signatures, theoretically. This is for low P, below 18%. You have the FFLO in the center. You have fully polarized wings. And you can see that here. This is the majority, this is the minority, and this is the difference. And at some point, beyond these dotted line here and over here, these two densities are the same. And that's, in fact, these two axial densities are the same. And that's an indicator that this is a fully paired wing in this low polarization limit. You go to the high polarization limit, then it's different. You still have the FFLO in the center, but then you have these polarized wings. And if you go outside of here, you can see the minority, which is in black, actually goes away. And the difference and the majority are the same. So it's a very clear signature, theoretically. Okay, this is data. So this is the high polarization limit. This is about 64%.
This is new data?
Huh?
This
is the new data. Yeah, and it's preliminary. So I probably hyped it up too much because it's got too much signal to noise. It's got really crappy signal to noise. But nonetheless, it shows the effect. So out in here, we're not claiming this is FFLO. This should say partially polarized. We don't detect FFLO at the moment, and we have some ideas on that. But if you look out in this region, again, this is the minority, and this is the majority. And here, it's partially polarized, the density difference. Out in here, it's fully polarized. The minority's actually gone all the way to zero. So that is in agreement with the theory where The minority at this point goes to zero. So that's consistent.
So why the
I don't know about signal to noise. If
we
can get to noise
standards. Signal to noise
sucks. This would be very exciting.
So why is there a difference of factor of two? I mean,
there is a difference in numbers. And so we have to measure our trap frequencies better, we think, to get better agreement. There are differences in numbers here, and there are differences in numbers here.
Well, that's LDA. Right?
Pardon?
That's
the
answer, plus LDA.
You can do
the answer with the trap, or you can.
What's the question?
Can you do the answer with the trap, or you have to use the LDA?
Oh, that is all the LDA.
Right.
Yeah.
So that makes a little difference in the x-axis.
So David separately has done some quantum Monte Carlo calculations, and he gets very good agreement with these beta on-site calculations. So we think that they're good. We think they're good, actually. Okay, now low polarization, and this is where the rubber hits the road. Because okay, here again, it's a partially polarized region in the middle. We do see that, and then out in here, it's the difference goes absolutely to zero. The two densities are exactly the same. We have a fully paired phase that sits on the outside of the whole thing. So we're really excited to see that one, because that one, this was the critical one.
We are all set.
Yeah, well, we have to do it. So Jason's referring to our DARPA grant. It depends on this, and it's up for renewal in a couple of months.
No, I think that the good news is that apart from this, that means you do have a whole chunk of FFL-like thing which one can explore, which will come next.
Yeah.
Step, yeah. But that is it looks good.
Yeah, I think so too. So, so there is a dimensional crossover, and this is exactly what you were asking. That if you can adjust this hopping between, a coupling between tubes, you should be able to go from a one-dimensional system to a three-dimensional system and see the inversion of that phase separation. So we've got a little bit of done a little bit of work on that.
Actually, I don't think it's appropriate to call this phase separation anymore, because you see the polarization changes continuously. It's actually indication that you have a second order transition. Nothing jumps out of the boundary.
Nothing jumps because it's the average over multiple tubes. It's not just a single tube, and so you won't expect to see any jump.
You use this algorithm to extract the tube at the center, right? So presumably the single tube.
So all of this is just axial density.
Haven't plotted this through the.
We have not plotted the central density. These are all integrated axial densities.
QE makes a jump.
The theory has a first order phase transition, I believe. But the theory in the experiment will not when you integrate a bunch of these tubes, because each of them has slightly different Fermi temperature.
Can you go back to the previous, look at data and the other?
Yeah.
So you were referring to this.
Yeah, so there's no jump in the theory. In this integrated thing. So this is...
The theory is also integrated.
It's all integrated. It's axial density. Because that's what we get experimentally. And so what Eric has done is to analyze this in terms of the data that we can get. So in principle, you can get the central tube. You can able transform it, but the signal to noise won't permit that.
I guess, strictly speaking, one thing there is the first order phase signature is kind of temperature. Because the main goal is have lot. Entropy is one day, mm-hmm. And so they can, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Then there is no phase transition. Strictly speaking, the large entropy switch domain was.
Yeah.
Actually, even in zero temperature, you probably don't get a
phase
transition either.
If
the domain was
out of
the positive interactions.
We could look at David Separley's Monte Carlo calculations. That might shed some light on things. I have them. I don't have them. Yeah, I do have them. So there are, this is finite numbers. So this is for 200 atoms. And This is the polarization that changes. I don't know if you want to call that discontinuous or not, but it's only 200 atoms, so it's never going to be discontinuous. So that's a single tube, by the way.
If you have a single tube, you ought to expect a kind of wedding cake structure.
You expect structure like that, yeah. Uh-huh.
Exactly. Are they taking the harmonic confinement into account?
In this system,
to get the wings,
yeah, they have to, yeah. Otherwise, they don't get the center. Yeah.
This is not the lattice. This is not the wedding cake type of thing. But this is one single tube. It's not. There's not no lattice on the tube. Along the tube. Yeah.
Okay, and there's also, I noticed in here, if people are interested, well, I only have a couple more slides, but this is the idea of Eric's analysis of these tubes. So you get tubes that, you know, they have to fit inside of this ellipsoid, and there's very few atoms on the outside and very many on the inside, and Eric realized that you could, by integrating through, you get all the thermodynamics in this harmonic potential. So it actually works out really well. Okay. So here, got four slides in a minute and a half. So there is a dimensional crossover, and this is enough lattice depth that the tubes are in the 1D limit. This is certainly in the 3D limit. And you could see it's very preliminary. This is partially polarized in here in the 1D case. It's fully paired in the 3D case because this is relatively flat-topped, and maybe you have to squint a little bit to see that. But when you go outside, this is clearly fully paired. This is the majority and minority have exactly the same density, whereas out in here, you know, they certainly the minority goes to zero, and it's really, you know, it's again, the signal to noise is not quite there yet, but it's suggestive.
So in principle, you can study the crossover from one.
Yeah, and so what we found preliminarily, at least, is that for lattice depths of more than about 8 recoils, it's 1D like, and for less than 6, 3D like.
Sorry, why is this not 3D like?
Because the outer wing here is fully polarized. You see the blue is above the noise, and it's pretty iffy. You have to see just a few data points in there, and I'm not willing to say that. I'm not willing to make a claim that that's an observation of that, but it's at least suggestive. It's clearly in the 1D case. It's clearly distinct.
So what's the picture of the excess velocity? What happens to the excess velocity?
Okay. So very interesting. So if this is FFLO in the middle, how do we see it? Well, there should be some modulation. It turns out density modulations from the calculations is really small in amplitude. But on the other hand, there should be two momentum peaks, plus or minus Q, where Q is KF1 minus KF2. And if we let them expand in time of flight, we should be able to see that.
You haven't done it yet.
We have not done it yet.
See, actually, Emmanuel and I were talking about that. He's actually very interested in going in this direction. But I also mentioned to him that some years, for example, I think if you sweep the cross flashback resonance, go to the molecular side, then the pair would become plus 2. But then, so that means that we have plus minus pairs. Regions.
Yeah.
Now I have good both condensate, but then somehow the phase off. So if I do the momentum distribution on the molecular side, then I would see a distinct peak come out in on the condensate. So I think experimentally it would be relatively easy to do that. You just switch to the molecular side and then just see the peak to see whether there should be.
Yeah. One of the issues is that there's of course broadening because KF1 and KF2 aren't, the difference isn't the same across the system.
But
across the tubes.
Yeah, that might, but you, definitely. But you so you would smear out. You don't have to.
Yeah.
But the fact that even you smear them out, there's a distinct thing coming out. The thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so our next steps are to systematically go through all this and vary things that we can vary, polarization, interaction, strength, and define these phase boundaries. We just talked about the FFLO state and how we might characterize it, and also this 1D to 3D crossover. All right, so I'm done. This is the main essential features of this system is phase separation. For large aspect ratio, there's surface tension and deformation. We've seen a dependence of aspect ratio in finite size on the behavior in the system in the terms of this deformation and the Clarkston limit. There are actually two distinct phases. There is a Sarma phase or a polarized superfluid phase, and there's a tricritical point in the phase diagram, and we do see data with high temperature data, which is consistent with that, and low temperature data, which is consistent with the 1D phase boundary. So we've been studying a 1D polarized gas. We have preliminary observations of these phase boundaries. So here's the group met there in front of the physics building, the old one. Let me particularly acknowledge Yan-An Liao, Sophie Rittner, who is did her PhD with John Reppe in supersolids, postdoc, Tobias Pabrota and Wenwei Li, and also Guthrie Partridge. And Guthrie's not in heaven, but he's not in the group anymore, and he's doing a postdoc in Paris. So kind of the next best thing. So thanks very much.
One is how easy would it be for you to implement spin-dependent optical lattices to study the effect of different masses?
For this system, very, very difficult because the
this is lithium
6. The problem is these two hyperfine sublevels are only 80 megahertz apart. That's 14 line widths. You need thousands of line width. Otherwise, you get spontaneous emission from the lattice.
What about doing ladders? Because we have much more control theoretically of ladders. You know, we can study ladders numerically. You know, for they did separately. I guess did the fixed node Monte Carlo because it has same problem in Monte Carlo.
It's in 1D. It's in 1D. So some of it was fixed node, but not all of it.
2D or higher dimensions would be very different. But ladders are much more
under control. Okay, so you're asking.
A lot of 2D physics already in ladders.
So the ladder system would be a system of parallel parallel tubes that they would be coupled pairwise.
Right, exactly.
These two, and
these
two. Okay. Well, maybe we should talk. It's maybe a way of realizing that.
And the other question is
I don't know off the top of my head.
The other question is the GINA group recently came up with a photoemission. They did photoemission experiments. They kind of solved the momentum solved spectrum.
Yeah.
Is that a very difficult experiment? Because I can imagine one that you can see the spin charge separation.
Very interesting. The signal to noise on that technique is not very good. And so the resolution is maybe not good enough to see some of those things. But, you know, they have to be looked at. I don't have a good answer for that.
More questions?
So this picture of the phase separation, this new phase separation is probably just that 1D density of states is large for low densities and small values.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
So I guess the obvious question is what about 2D, where you have flat density of states?
Good question. Nobody's done that phase diagram. So there's a problem. nobody's done that one.
What would be that there's less phase separation, there's more chance for
yeah.
phases?
Yeah, that's interesting. So you're absolutely right that in 1D, the more strongly interacting is low density. And so that so then it inverts. In 2D, that's not the case. So I guess it's flat, right? So it's
I think that 2D not obvious. 2D is maybe the question whether I on the 2D, whether I have lattice or whether it is. Then the FFL loses its advantage because in 1D, the only way to scatter or to enhance the pairing, but in 2D, the phase cut off. A lot, but on
the
other
hand,
larger, then I would have a better
nesting. At least it's not clear what is inside the world, but the inside or outside is better for the curve phase. So in 1D and 3D, it's clear, there's a clear distinction between inside and outside. There's
yeah.
A high density of state spaces,
right.
Inside and it's outside in 1D.
Yeah.
In 2D, at least this is not clear. So
yeah, it's not clear which way it would come down.
And you should just have to switch off one of the lattices.
You would need a third lattice to confine it in all dimensions. You'd need a third laser beam to confine it.
So you would just switch off one of your laser beams. Then one you confine it, and then
yes.
Two of these discs.
Yes, then you would have a 1D array of pancakes, a stack of pancakes. Yeah, there's issues with gravity and so on. we thought about these 2D systems, and they're experimentally pretty tough, but it's not impossible.
Okay, I think my question is going one higher dimension. So in the third dimensional, in the three dimensional results that you showed, what is the final conclusion regarding the aspect ratio? I didn't quite catch that. What is the final conclusion?
So what we've seen is a aspect ratio dependence on the deformation and Clarkson limit. So going back to here. So we can tune this parameter depending on how we configure these optical traps, we can tune this aspect ratio continuously, essentially from 3 to 25. And what we found is that with 6, actually with an aspect ratio of 6, which is what the MIT group has, that we're still seeing some deformation. It's very small, but we still see it. On the other hand, we have considerably fewer atoms than they do, maybe a factor of 30 in this experiment. But when we get below about 5, then it really does look like LDA holds, and we see the Clarkson limit, and you don't see any deformation. The aspect ratio doesn't change.
So is that completely understood theoretically?
No, it is not. No. So the bottom line is that there's some kind of a the surface tension seems to stabilize phase separation. So when you have these elongated systems, it seems to favor superfluidity and phase separation. And there are calculations. People are starting to work on this. I know Ueda, Han Pu at Rice, several groups are starting to look. I think Joachim Schwenk, who was here last week, is working on similar calculations to try to understand where the stability comes from. And it's not understood theoretically.
Questions? Now let's thank Randy again. And, I'm going to use the PowerPoint or are you a good theorist?